Accession number 10165, reel number 12.
Martin McLean, reel 12. You were telling me about the inspection for the stick man, and the officer just stepped back. What would happen now?
The orderly officer then announced out who's his stick orderly, and he'd called out by this, number one of the guard, or number two of the guard, or three, whatever the man's number one. Battalion commanders, command officers, stick orderly. And the man would take a smart pace forward, turn to the right, shoulder arms, turn about and step off, and join on the left of the flank of the staff parade that's assembled. And then order arms, front up, and stand at ease, or stand at attention, unless the rest of the parade has stood at ease. We didn't automatically stand at ease in these days. We waited until the word of command, stand at ease, was given, as the same with attention. And then the guard had to march off. The next word of command from the officer would be, guard commander, take post. Guard commander and bugler, take post. And they'd have a certain little drill to go through. The guard commander would turn about. The bugler would start marching forward and march in front of the guard. The orderly side, the guard commander marched to the rear of the guard. And then the orderly officer said, guard to your duties, quick march. And the guard commander would then take over. Guard to your duties, quick march. And off that step. And then a lot of ceremonial drill was involved with this. He'd give the word of command to the orderly officer, guard eyes right. And then instead of turn into file or any of that nature, whenever they moved, they had to move in line, so that if he had to do a left turn, it'd have to be moved to left form, so that the whole guard came round together. And the same thing until they got onto the beach, where the guard had to walk in front of the guard room. The guard would be halted, formed up, dressed up, stood at ease, and then the lance corporal would receive an order, along with the bugler, from the guard commander to the guard room, fall out. Not dismiss, fall out. And in there, you went in and took over the prisoners that was there. You took over part of the duties that you were entitled to do. Take over from your lance corporal who was waiting of the guard who had to come off, which was, you are relieving NCO. The other one was the outgoing NCO. He was waiting to get off guard. So you take over any special orders from him regarding anything that may entail and duties. And the orderly, the guard commander would do the same thing with his opposite number, and the same with the bugler. They'd take over orders. The guard by this time would be standing at ease on the marching beat. And if any officer was to pass at the time, the senior man of the guard would call the guard just simply to attention. There'd be no present arms and anything, because it's an official thing. They know that the guard, they just call them to attention till they got away. And then the guard commander and lance corporal would go out on the guard again, on the order. They'd fall in from the guard commander, the bugler, the guard commander, and the lance corporal would take a position again. And the guard commander would turn around, give the orders to the guard, telling them which one had to do the beat. Actually, it was always number one had to do the first 2 hours on duty. And this could be a crucifying thing, it was an old soldier's trick, but I'll tell you this in just a second. And then he'd give the guard the guard room, dismiss, and the people would go into the guard room, and they couldn't loosen off equipment or anything of that nature. They had to remain fully dressed until the guard commander said, right, take off your large pack. But that's as much as you're allowed to take off, because you're on call any minute of the day to turn out for the things that used to term as a guard's duty, which were all very well drilled in. The guard had to march up and down his beat in a smart and soldier-like manner, and he had to stand with the guard at reveille, retreat and tattoo, to the orderly officer and the captain of the week, once by day and once by night, to the command officer and the brigade commander at any time that they pass, unless the command officer acknowledges he doesn't want the guard, because they didn't pester you too much, because the order room and the CO were just behind you. And then you are taught to call out the guard for fire or any unusual occurrence, all well drilled in it. As a matter of fact, when the orderly officer came to inspect you, and he'd asked the sentries their duties, and that was what you had to spout off. So the man was marching up and down, his beating a smart and soldier-like manner. The others were in the guard room. Now, I did say that I'd mention it can be crucifying, this, because some lads couldn't get their boots up that crucial high standard of efficiency that was required for a guard. So they'd borrow their mate's boots, one of their pals' boots. And no matter who you are or what you are, your feet are entirely different to other people's. And when you wear other people's boots, and they're tight laced, and you've got your putties on top, which stopped a lot of the circulation in the legs, by the way, you marched up and down, you're beating a smart and soldier-like manner until your feet were crucifying you. You could see the shimmers of heat coming off them at times, nearly. It was so painful. But you had to get on with it without any grimace of pain and get on with it until late at night, after the end of the soldier's day, at 10:15 at night, when maybe the stick orderly, who was the command officer stick orderly, his job was to go and look after the guard also, go and collect the guard's bedding from the barrack room, collect anything they wanted, collect their meals at back the guard room, and do a lot of other menial chores, but he didn't do the special duty of guard. That was the CO's orderly, but he had to also run messages if required by the adjutants. If they passed this special, you had a special stick which you carried, a swagger cane, marked, and it was the command officer's stick when you had this. If you got 3 passes in the stick orderly in row, you got it 3 times in succession, you're given a special stick as the command officer's special stick orderly. I don't know if we retained this stick or not, but we got a special stick. Maybe when you're on the guard's tour of duty, because I couldn't give all the men who'd obtained this privilege a stick to walk around the barracks with. We had our own swag again. So it must have just been for a period that we received a special stick. Anyway, at 10 o'clock at night, staff parade, everybody, all the guards out. And after 10 o'clock at night, then you can, the guard commander can relax a bit, allow you to loosen your equipment off your belts, not take it off, change your boots, which meant taking off your putties, change your boots, change it to things more comfortable. And your khaki by this time might be all smudged and greasy with your rifle, and you had to get all that clean. Sometimes when you were on special guards, they gave you a thing, a flap, which you buttoned over your epaulette and buttoned on your buttons so that you didn't mark your khaki, which was a great thing, and we all went for them, and I did, always. As a matter of fact, one had them, all the guard had to have them. Sometimes you couldn't find them, and you got your khaki all mucked up. Anyway, you could change your boots off. Now, we have a sentry on duty 24 hours a day, and I told you before that they had to turn out for all different occasions, and it was the duty of the orderly officer to come once during his tour of duty of a night time, once by day and once by night, to turn the guard out to see if there's any deficiency in the guard, to see if there's anyone missing, see if the guard was fully alert. And he'd come sneaking up, some of them would, on the guard, from out of the darkness and walk straight in front of the guard, and the sentry would have to call the guard too, which was the normal thing. Some would march straight from the officer's mess across the square and stand in front of the guard, which was the indication he wants the guard. Otherwise, if he's just passing, he'd give him the ordinary salute according to his rank. If he stands in front of the guard, that means he wants the guard called out. So you call the guard out, orderly sergeant and orderly officer doing their duties. They inspect the guard and dismiss you at the guard room again. And then even then, you can't guarantee that the night's free for you, because the captain of the week can come over any once during his guard's tour of duty. If he hasn't been over during the daytime, you can gamble he's going to come over during the night sometime to inspect the guard. So you're on top form all of the time. And when your 24 hours were up, you are sitting at the tables. We had 6-foot tables and wooden benches. You had your blankets there, but no way could you use them. They were just there as a shoe, I think. We used to doss, put our heads down and sleep on the with our heads on the table, sitting on the form. Until the next morning, before reveille, we were washed, shaved, cleaned up, so that we were on the staff parade at 6:30 the next morning, fully bright and alert, the same as the remainder. So when the 24 hours of the guard duty went off. The same similar occurrence was happening on the square. This was every day whilst quarter guard duties was on. Maybe on a Sunday, the RSM would have the BOS take the guard. The RSM could be excuse himself. But every day, the same routine, the orderly officer, the RSM, the guard, the orderly officers and everything, for Guard Mountain. And it was very serious affair, as I mentioned. And then the new guard took over from us. We marched off, and we were dismissed by the guard commander, and we went back to our barrack room. Although we hadn't had much sleep, it may seem silly, this. You may say, well, that's you finished for the day. It wasn't. A guard had 2 hours in which to prepare itself for the normal day's duties of a platoon or the company, whatever it was doing. If they were away on a route march, you were laughing. You didn't go out on the route march. You couldn't catch them up because it was all walk and there's no lorries to run you there. So they'd give you duties around the camp, fatigues in the lines, maybe rolling blankets, or if the blankets had to go at the cleaners, they'd always find you jobs to do. Garden, cutting the lawns, digging with company garden plots and all this sort of thing. So after 2 hours, having come off guard, and they used to time it from 9 o'clock when you were still on guard till, say, 11 o'clock, you were, couldn't be taken for duties. So after that time, you could be taken. And make no doubt about it, you are taken. You are always given jobs. So that was the end of your guard duty. Well, this went on, and I used to lap this up. I must honestly say, I loved army life.
I'd just like to ask, you've been with the battalion quite a while now. How are you getting on with your fellow other ranks and the lower NCOs?
No bother at all. I found that I was very well accepted. I think part of the breakthrough of a man's getting to be liked by his fellow man, if he takes part in sport, if he takes part in a manly sport like rugby, and the senior tussling and roughing up at rugby, and they know that you're a strong man and a fit man, and the same with cross-country run, you grew popular by, they were just some of the means which you grew popular with your own type. When I first got made Lance Corporals, I was accepted with the Corporals, and Lance Corporals, no bother at all. I could say I was well liked. You always have enemies. Somebody maybe you've had defaulters to, or somebody you've crossed in some way or other. But in the main, even in the barrack room, when you first made Lance Corporal, and you've got to instill into the others that now you're a boss, you've got to do as you're told. At times you've got to get a hold of an old soldier, a real old soldier. I talk about Brady and Lindsay, the men with 16 year long service good conduct stripes in. Make them stand to attention in front of you and rollick them for some misdemeanour. Simple things, such as not like stand to attention to you or not calling your Lance Corporal. You dress them down, as we call it. They accept it. There was no bad feeling about it. They just accepted it. But the thing was, if you start taking advantage of your stripe and calling men up unnecessarily and rollicking them, then you're on the black books of the men. I have no doubt they were. Now, I'm an old man now. I read of cases recently of what happens in other units regarding bullying and forcing men to do things and this, that, and the other. You talk about the dark old ages. This could never, never happen in my time. And wouldn't happen because we thought so much of one another. If you'd done this, let me tell you that you'd be waylaid by the men of a night time in the dark and you'd be given a sound thrashing. Whether you're a corporal or lance corporal or no matter what rank, you get bashed up if they thought you were taking the urine out of them, as they used to term it. They'd give you a good hiding. And so, a lance corporal, I always felt, and I've seen this happen with other lance corporals who got stripe happy and they were barking and shouting at everybody, making people's lives unnecessarily nasty. And then the next thing, the sergeant would get a hold of them. Hey, look, you're a lance corporal now, just contain it. These men have got a life to live. And they control you and pull you down a peg if you start being too bossy and too shoutful at the men. And in this way, lance corporals were brought up in the true manner of what they had to do by being pulled up by the sergeant majors, the sergeants, and anyone if they thought they were overstepping the mark. We never picked on an individual to persecute as they do today. If we did, then that man had right to go before the company commander and he'd complain about you, and that would be a mark in your black book. So you avoided that, didn't you? Anyway,
they had no initiation ceremonies and things like that.
None at all. No initiation ceremonies, as the talk is, no. I've told you the crude things that happened in the army. That was if a man was caught stealing, or a man was found, I just mentioned it, an NCO was found being too bossy with the men, he'd get punished in some way or other. So there was no initiation rites as such in the army. In fact, I'll say this, we lived as a happy family. We used to, hey Bill, hey Tom. But when you were a Lance Corporal, you had to address the man by his surname, Wilson, Thompson, Eric. But they accepted it. But we're all great pals.
What was the division of responsibility between officers and NCOs, particularly the senior ones, NCOs? Who was, do you think, the most important in the running of the peacetime 2nd Battalion?
There is no doubt about who was the most important man was the commanding officer. And you ask about relegation of duties and responsibilities. Well, in part were individual training as a young NCO. One of the things you had to purchase through the PRI was a copy of Regimental Standing Orders. And it was a book which I have an old copy of it, all free to mine. And it indicates every duty that an officer, orderly officer, right down to everybody, what they have to do, their responsibilities, as far as the running of, or the efficient running of a battalion. And you use it as a sort of Bible. And it lays down the distinct levels of what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, and in each division they have the same sort of acceptance of these rules, so that once you know your standing orders, then you don't overstep the mark. But if you do overstep the mark, someone will jump on you for doing that thing. The only time you could overstep the mark, if you have assumed the responsibility, like I mentioned, when the incident where the fighting in the barrack room and the people had gone on leave, and the BOS had put me in charge of the battalion, then I assume responsibility of BOS as well as BOC. But it's only then could you overstep the mark where you had been given a further responsibility.
What about between the officers and the NCOs generally? You think the officers were, they did what they were supposed to, or did was the battalion really run by the NCOs? I mean, that's the sort of thing.
Well, I'll tell you honestly, the battalion was run by the RSM down. RSM, company sergeants, colour sergeants, who are the CQMSs now, sergeants, corporals, lance corporals. The training, the discipline of the battalion resolved entirely upon them people. And they used to force this in no uncertain manner. For instance, there's always hosts of people on defaulters from some misdemeanour, maybe a grave misdemeanour or a serious one, or a simple one, like I tell you about my incident where I got 2 days CB. And they maintain discipline in this manner. Now, the officers had a different code, whatever, to the men. Now, they were Sandhurst-trained officers by this, I might mention. That was the academy at Camberley. And they had their own gentlemanly approaches and method of things. They'd come along when all the discipline was finished. They knew discipline, let's put it that way, but they never interfered with the discipline of a battalion, other than if somebody disobeyed their order, then he'd order a sergeant major or a sergeant or lance corporal to put the man in charge. And you'd ask what the charge was and he'd tell you, and the officer may come along as evidence, he may not. The company commander or command officer would take your word that this man was insolent or back incident or refused to obey an order given by an officer. We were tight on discipline, and our RSM was the martinet of all discipline. He was like a button stick, and when he passed you, you had to smarten yourself up, button loose, or untidy hair not parted, and silly little things like that. slouching around with your hands in your pockets, you're in trouble. When you walked around the barracks, outside of your barrack room, they weren't so hot. They let you have a certain ease of feeling that you weren't on parade. But when the RSM passed, you were properly to attention and what have you, and watching yourself, because at least a little whisper, a flick of a stick from him, you're in trouble. And then discipline was just the thing you accepted.
So that was the what about that was discipline was the job of the NCOs, RSM downwards.
WOs, NCOs, yes.
Training, that would be largely...
Training was, we had a weapon training staff. That meant we had a special sergeant in charge of weapon training. And he'd have a weapon training cadre, which would be responsible for ensuring, in a long run, not the men, they didn't have the time nor the space to take all the men, but their job was to ensure that the junior NCOs knew their weapon training, so that they in turn could pass it down to the men.
So again, that was really NCOs as well.
Yes, and then the same with drill. Of course, you have to know drill, because you're giving orders to men, and you give the word of command on the wrong foot, like you're marching, you want the men to halt or turn to the right or left. They're all a special method laid down in the drill book for when you give that word of command, like the right foot passing the left or the left foot passing the right, and different words of command for different movements.
So what was the job of the officers? I'm not saying they haven't
got... Can I come back, finish me on drill? The junior NCOs were well grounded in what is called as the junior NCOs cadre, which was carried out in the early part of the year about the individual training time, when either a sergeant major detailed by the RSM would take you on drill, somebody who really knew drill, and they'd tear you to pieces if you'd done the wrong thing. And the RSM would sometimes come out and take you on drill through the drill book from A to Z, and they'd make you do these drill movements, and also they'd take you out in turn, and such as I was a little red-faced man, and I had blonde hair, very blonde hair at the time. And I never used to get brown with the sun. I used to turn red, burn. And I was always out in the sun. And one particular sergeant major called Joey Davison, who incidentally became a great friend of mine when we were sergeant majors together, he used to say, "That little red-faced Lance Corporal, come out here. Teach the men how to turn the rights. Now I'll give you a demonstration." He'd give a demonstration as per the drill book. "Now, do you teach them the same movement, only use your own words and don't imitate me?" It left you thinking, how do you show the men how to do something which you've learned off a drill book, which he's done from the drill book? Now, how do you teach them to do the thing? Well, this is the type of training that they give you in drill, so that you could see a training cadre developed from a group of lads who could drill and give words of command. And after the end of the 3 weeks of the month, before they were going to pass out, you'd see them perfect in words of command. Now, I say that literally because it was my privilege later on in life, after the war, to be drill sergeant major of a battalion where I drilled a training cadre of junior NCOs and likely junior men who would most likely make NCOs, drill them into a state of light infantry drill, and they came from all different light infantry battalions to form this battalion, drill them from a small machine to a machine working together, so that you got great pride out of doing it. And the men themselves, you knew they were proud. Even I'm talking about now pre-war, they knew the training cadre was proud because their standard drill had developed. Their method of turning on the march was developed. In other words, it's like going back to the depot where you're in top form, you're getting revision on it, but now it was your turn to know the orders, to give them, to shout to the men, and speak out like a proper NCO on a square, shouting the full length of the square at the men. So there we have it. You have the WO or the RSM taking you on drill, and you have the training cadre taking the NCOs on weapon training. So that when you got in front of the men, you knew what to do and how to get the best out of the men.
So that's discipline, weapon training and drill largely down to the NCOs. What was the officer's particular function then, generally? What were they responsible for? What was their role?
Well, let's take the platoon commander. The platoon commander would be come from a Sandhurst and be given a platoon. He'd have a platoon sergeant. And they were responsible for turned out and prayed with the men. Now, as far as discipline and weapon training is concerned, nil. I say nil. I'm talking about pre-war days. They would join the company and join the platoon and stand and watch and interfere or ask questions. They were well trained as well, having been to Sandhurst. Don't get the idea that they didn't know anything. They just had a code of honour whereby they wouldn't interfere with drill parades if a sergeant or a corporal or lance corporal is taken, only if they saw things going seriously wrong. And they'd interfere in a diplomatic way and say, do you not think you should be doing this? But they didn't, as a rule, interfere with anything at all, other than they might talk to the men later on about the reason why they're doing this drill or why they're doing this sort of training, to encourage them to think it's just as nabore. There's a reason for it, for ceremonial parades, drill for ceremonial parades, for guards of honour, for guards and all that sort of thing. And it was right down to the company commander. Now, the company commander had the responsibility of the discipline of the company at large. He used to appear every day and take his company orders, which was company orders, was similar to the CO. Any men who misdemeanours was brought before him, given either company punishment. If there was a rule book laid down, by the way, a company commander would only give a certain amount of punishment, not too much. And if it was above his means, then he'd have to pass the man on to the commanding officer. And then again, let's repeat this, that if the punishment laid down that a commanding officer can inflict upon a man, if it becomes more than this, then he's got to remand the man for a court-martial. So everything was laid down, what they could do and what they couldn't do, in a way of meeting out punishment to men. So the company commander would take his first job would be take company office. Then he'd inspect the company lines, as I mentioned. Some days he wouldn't bother inspecting the company lines because it's got everybody in QV and it's QVIV, and it's also got a big interference with training. So if we're on training, he'd come around and inspect what we're doing, but we wouldn't stop training. The Durhams had a funny way of going on. I got involved with this at the Albright War. I was taking some RA machine, teaching men the Bren gun down in Brighton. And their commanding officer came up, and because I didn't call the men to attention, I got wrong. Now, our way of going on was, the only time you stop your instruction, if the commanding officer stand there, he's just wandering around and seeing what's going on. He doesn't want saluting and slavering around, no interference with instruction. Only if he gives you a signal like that, then you call the men to attention. Now, we didn't call the men to attention when the company commander came upon us, unless he gave a signal that he wanted, he was going to speak official to the men. And so they observed the training, and they'd make notes if they didn't think an instructor was up on his marks, a sharp report to the sergeant major, who in turn would get a hold of the man. And his duties were then training the men in fieldcraft. As I mentioned before, sand model lectures, taking them on the moors, training them the layout of a company, and other things of that nature, fieldcraft, field defences, as the training developed.
So they were tactical?
They were tactical, yes. You could see it.
So,
and of course, when they went on ceremonial parades, they were in charge. That was his company. He gave all the words of command of the company. And the same with the battalion commander, when he was on parade, he gave all the orders.
Were there any instances amongst either the officers or NCOs of people financially abusing their position? I mean, there are many fiddles that can go on in an army. Were there any examples of that that you knew of in the peacetime?
Well, I can assure you that the code of practice among the officers would never allow this. We of the lower ranks would never have known it of an officer. It would be hushed up, and a man would have to pay for it. He'd have to make up any discrepancies, because officers that joined the army them days was men of means. I don't go into too much of it because I know so little of it, but it was a man had to go to Sandhurst and he had to have a certain background and a certain income.
What about the NCO?
And the NCOs didn't have the handling of the books. For instance, you're talking about finance. The colour sergeant used to handle the pay of the men. That meant that he'd work out how much pay a man was getting every week. He'd work out company stoppages, how many naffy chits the man had got. Now, naffy chits is something I haven't spoke about. Men get hard up in the army, especially after being on the weekend, maybe to Darlington or on the beer, they're short of cash. And they always want to eat. The fresh air and the exercise we get, they always want to eat. So they have no money to go across the canteen for to buy a cup of tea or water or a pint of beer, whatever it is.